Okay, good afternoon, or good morning, everybody. It's still about 11:30. We'll go ahead and call our next case, which is case number 619-46, Ralph Torres versus the State of Nevada. We have Ms. Kilpatrick for the appellant, Mr. Mills for the respondent. Ms. Kilpatrick, you may proceed, and would you like to reserve some time for rebuttal?
Yes, Chief Justice, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. You may proceed.
May it please the court. The issue before the court this morning is whether the discovery of an outstanding arrest warrant attenuates the illegality of an unlawful seizure. This is a case of first impression in Nevada. The Supreme Court of the United States has not decided this issue. The federal and state courts are split. Some circuits and state courts say that the discovery of an outstanding arrest warrant weighs in favor of attenuation. Others don't. The issue comes before this court as a result of an event that occurred late one February evening in Elko County, in the city of Elko. What was happening was Ralph Torres, a shorter man, was wearing a hoodie and walking across a bridge in downtown Elko. Officer Shelley saw Mr. Torres and questioned in his mind whether or not Torres was old enough to be out past curfew. So Officer Shelley pulls his patrol vehicle around to the bottom of the bridge and approaches Torres and asks Torres if he can speak with him. Officer Shelley asks Torres for identification, which Torres willingly provides. At which point in time, Officer Shelley sees that Torres is practically 30 years old. But instead of giving the ID back to Torres and letting Torres be on his way, Officer Shelley retains the ID and runs Torres for warrants. A little less than 5 minutes later, dispatch tells Officer Shelley that Torres does in fact have a warrant, but they can't confirm whether or not it's extraditable. Several minutes pass. We don't know exactly how long. The record isn't clear about how many minutes pass between the time the warrant initially pops and the warrant is confirmed. But ultimately, Officer Shelley arrests Mr. Torres as a result of these warrants. Upon his arrest, Torres informs Officer Shelley that he has a gun in his pants. He says, "Don't freak out, I've got a gun." And so the search incident to arrest leads to the discovery of the firearm. Torres was charged with being an ex-felon in possession of a firearm and other charges, but ultimately he pleaded guilty to ex-felon in possession of a firearm and reserved his right to appeal the lower court's decision denying the defendant's motion to suppress. Now, in the motion to suppress, the defendant argued that the initial detention was the problem, not the presence of the outstanding warrant. The motion to suppress focused on Officer Shelley's decision to retain the ID, but the district court didn't decide whether or not that passed constitutional muster. Instead, the court went straight to the attenuation doctrine and said, and held rather, that the presence of the outstanding warrant purged the taint of any possible illegality of the stop. Now, this court in other cases, such as Beckman, has decided that when we have an issue that requires a prior finding, that we have to make a decision regarding the prior finding, whether or not, in Beckman, the lower court decided the issue on exigency, and the defense had argued the illegality of the stop. And so what happened was this court focused on the illegality of the stop first. So I'd like to talk about that, or if the court would prefer, I can talk about attenuation, whichever the court would like.
Why don't you do whatever you feel is appropriate, then?
Okay, well, if we're going to talk about attenuation, which I think is the issue before this court.
Well, before you talk about attenuation, your argument is that the detention was an improper or illegal seizure.
Correct.
Wouldn't it be best to focus on that?
Yes, it would. I was going to say that attenuation, if you're going to use the attenuation doctrine, then you have to presuppose that there's a seizure. So if we're going to focus on whether or not the retention of an ID is in fact a seizure, the courts are split on that as well. Lots of courts hold in several different directions. Florida, which is the court that the state relies upon in the Golfin case, has a string cite which talks about all the courts that hold that retaining an ID is not problematic. However, lots of courts hold the other way, such as D.C., New Mexico, Utah, Virginia, the Ninth Circuit, the Tenth Circuit, the Second Circuit, the Sixth, 11th, Minnesota, Oregon, Washington, the Eighth, and the Fifth. All have a problem with retaining an ID for the purposes of running for warrants and find that that could lead to part of the totality of the circumstances involving a seizure.
Well, in this particular case, though, isn't there an element here, an issue here, that perhaps doesn't exist in those other cases? The reason that he was stopped, the probable cause for the stop, was that he was underage, past curfew. And if the suspect hands an ID to the officer, why doesn't he have a right to determine whether or not he is, in fact, the individual portrayed in the driver's license? Why can't he verify that if he truly has a suspicion he's underage? It could be a fake ID. It could be something that raised the concern.
I think that the officer can verify that if there's anything suspicious in the ID that leads the officer to conclude that the ID may be fake, or if the picture in the ID doesn't match the person in the that's in front of him. If there's some reasonable, articulable suspicion that the officer can state objectively, hey, this doesn't look right, then I think that the officer can investigate further. But retaining the ID for the purposes of running a warrants check just to for everyone that the officer contacts is unreasonable.
Is there anything in the reports that indicated he might have had suspicions about the validity of the ID as opposed to simply taking it to run warrants?
No. In fact, the lower court made a finding of that, and I asked the question directly to Officer Shelley, was there anything about the ID that seemed fake or suspicious? And he said no. Okay. And when I asked Officer Shelley, why did you keep the ID and run him for warrants? Officer Shelley responded, because I run everyone I contact. He used the verb contact for warrants. So if Officer Shelley's running everyone he contacts for warrants, that would mean that, you know, a woman that witnesses an auto accident and writes a witness statement and hands it over would have to sit there with a car full of screaming toddlers while the officer's running her for warrants and her groceries are melting and her toddler really needs to go to the bathroom.
But don't you think they don't run them for warrants, especially like in Clark and Washoe, the urban areas that they run? They stop somebody in a car. This is different because the person isn't in a car. But if a person's in a car, they go, they get the registration, the proof of insurance, and the driver's license. They go back to their car. Guess what's in that car? A police car, a computer, and they run it. So, I mean, tell me why that's not different than, does the car make the difference here?
I don't think it does. And the reason is because in the situation that you described, I am hoping that in the course of running for warrants, that doesn't extend the length of the stop, which is the issue in Beckman. I think if the running for warrants extends the length of the stop impermissibly and it's not de minimis, then there's a problem. I do not think that there is a difference because the person is a pedestrian. Some may argue that if a citizen gives his license to an officer while the citizen is driving, he's automatically seized because he can't drive away without his license. But the same thing is true with a pedestrian. We can't do hardly anything in our society without an ID. We can't get on a plane. We can't cash a paycheck. We can't go to a movie. There's so many things that we can't do. And in our state, which is predominantly a tourist state, taking someone's ID does not allow them to feel free to leave. They can't just walk away without their ID because they probably wouldn't be able to get home. So I don't think that it makes a difference whether we're talking about a pedestrian or we're talking about a person in a car. The issue is whether or not the running for warrants lengthens the stop. And in this case, it did. It took all of 2 seconds for Officer Shelley to look at that ID and notice that Mr. Torres was nearly 30 years old. At that point in time, he could have just handed it back, and he didn't. A reasonable person would not have felt free to leave. And it's hard to say that it would be a consensual encounter, because we're talking about the middle of the night in Elko in February. It's a little cold. It's not just the time of year where people just want to sit around on a bridge and have a chat. So going to the attenuation doctrine, the state relies upon Green in its brief, which relies upon Brown from the United States Supreme Court. Brown lists 3 factors in the totality test that weigh in favor of or against attenuation. Those 3 factors are temporal proximity, the presence of an intervening circumstance, and the purpose and flagrancy of the stop. Now, in my briefs, I have asked the court not to follow Green's reasoning and apply Brown to this case. Brown was about the voluntariness of a confession and whether or not Miranda warnings purged the taint of the unlawful arrest and allowed the confession to be admissible. We're not talking here about something that the defendant did to purge the taint. And I think the analysis needs to be radically different when we're talking about something that the defendant did, like give a confession, or some cases have used Brown to decide whether or not breaking free and running away attenuates the taint, versus a case like this one where the defendant did nothing. This unreasonable logic started in the Green case. And after Green applied the Brown factors to a situation like this, several states got on board and said, hey, let's use this 3-prong test. But the test is wrong. One of the reasons why the test is wrong is because so many of these states have just tossed out the first factor and said that the first factor doesn't matter. The first factor is temporal proximity. Well, in a situation like ours, the temporal proximity of the seizure and the ultimate finding of the evidence is going to be quite quick because we have a statute that requires that we've got a 60-minute rule. And with regard to the purpose and flagrancy, which is the 3rd prong, I'm skipping over the 2nd prong for a second. The 3rd prong is the purpose and flagrancy of the officer, and that's been interpreted in many ways. But the purpose and flagrancy really doesn't apply because we're talking about subjective intent of the officer with purpose and flagrancy. And our Fourth Amendment jurisprudence has trained our minds not to talk about subjective intent when we're talking about probable cause. Unless the court has further questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
You have about 2.5 minutes, so you may reserve that time. Mr. Mills.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mark Mills. I represent the respondent, the state of Nevada, in this case. And as stated by the appellant, the issue in this case, the issue before the court, is whether, assuming that Officer Shelley's detention was unlawful, whether the subsequent discovery of an outstanding warrant and an arrest on that warrant constitutes an intervening circumstance sufficient to undo or dissipate or purge the taint of that unlawful detention. Now, there are a couple of other kind of sub-issues moving about in this case. One of those, which was addressed in appellant's argument, is whether it was an unlawful detention in the first place. The other kind of sub-issue is whether Brown is applicable to this situation. So what I would like to do is maybe address those 2 sub-issues first and then move on to Brown and the application of the Brown factors to this case. First of all, with respect to the issue of whether Officer Shelley unlawfully detained the appellant, whether there was even a constitutional violation at all. The district court passed on that issue and didn't rule on it. The district court stated that despite some reservations about it, she didn't see any fit to decide that issue. She jumped straight to the attenuation doctrine. That issue was never decided before by the district court. It is not really before the court in this issue, although it's implicated because in getting to the attenuation doctrine, there's kind of an assumption of a primary illegality. So I will address that briefly. In this case, there's a number of theories under which Officer Shelley's conduct would have been lawful. One of those is that he was operating under reasonable suspicion and that this was a lawful detention. Another theory is that the entirety of this was consensual. And either of those could be arguable theories under this case. And for example, reasonable suspicion. It's late at night, 1 o'clock in the morning, he sees a person of small stature stumbling down the bridge, swaying as if intoxicated, again, small in stature, wearing a hooded sweatshirt. Officer Shelley thought, it's after curfew, this person looks small, maybe young, I'm going to initiate contact.
You're saying he could have stopped, he could use stop and frisk on him?
Excuse me?
Under that scenario, are you saying that he could have done a stop and frisk?
Stop, yes. A frisk, no.
But why? If you stop somebody and you're an officer, why would you frisk him to make sure he's safe instead of getting maybe your head blown off by somebody who has a gun?
No.
Well, you're saying there's reasonable suspicion because he happens to be short, swaying, Hispanic. No. What else?
Yeah, under Terry, there's a couple of different things. You've got a Terry stop or detention, you've got a Terry frisk, and in order to conduct a Terry frisk, I think there's got to be some sort of indication that the person might be armed. And I think in Officer Shelley's mind, he wasn't concerned about the person being armed, he was concerned about intoxication and curfew and those types of things. So I think there's reasonable suspicion, in his mind at least. I mean, maybe, you know, looking back at this, maybe it doesn't rise to that level, but in his mind, that's what he was thinking. These are the reasons for stopping him. But even if there's not reasonable suspicion, then you've got, this was the fact that this was clearly a consensual encounter. He waits for him to get to the bottom of the bridge. He doesn't have his lights on, doesn't pull a firearm, isn't threatening or intimidating. He just initiates contact with him. The person voluntarily produces his identification. And this is where it gets kind of tricky. And I think this whole issue about whether the retention of identification constitutes a seizure, I think it could, but also it could be within the context of a consensual encounter.
Counsel, you use the term consensual. That would, to me, mean that the party consented. Was he consenting only because the person wasn't a uniformed officer? I don't think he just said, I'm just going to give my ID to anybody. So why do you think it's consensual, not a stop ordered by a police officer?
Again, I believe this is a close call as to whether the entirety of this, including the running of the ID, is consensual. I think I've looked at the cases on this, and the cases make a distinction between...
Consensual tends to mean voluntary. How do we get voluntary?
The cases make a distinction between request and demand, for example. It gets down into the nitty-gritty semantics. You know, the courts talk about whether there was a request for identification versus a demand for identification. So the demeanor, the tone of the voice of the officer, whether he phrases it in the form of a question versus a command, it gets into those kinds of fact-determinative.
So it's your proposition that he was free to say no?
Potentially, he could have.
Mr. Mills, that's an interesting observation. I wonder whether Heibel offers some guidance on this subject. Constitutionally, didn't the U.S. Supreme Court conclude in Heibel that the extent of what you are required to do is provide identification when asked?
That's correct.
And that ends it, doesn't it? In terms of...
Yes, as far as the constitutionality of that statute and what it allows, yes, that's what the court decided. But what I'm suggesting is...
Doesn't that imply that any further retention by the officer of the ID would exceed what you're constitutionally required to do?
I agree that it potentially could, if it's a detention. But what I'm suggesting is that...
Counsel has argued that on the detention question, there's competing authority, and you're making the same point. For purposes of this court's decision, if we have already seen the Heibel case and how the Supreme Court handled that, wouldn't it make sense that the retention of the ID would be driven by whether there's some reasonable suspicion that it is fake or it has a problem?
Yes, if that's the basis for retaining the identification. And if there is no reasonable suspicion, and if it is a retention that detains the person, then yes, that potentially, that's a problem. However, what I'm suggesting is that I've seen courts hold that the retention of the identification to conduct a warrant search could, under certain circumstances, be consensual, which wouldn't implicate the Fourth Amendment at all. And it is a close call.
Is there anything in this record, either by the testimony of the officer or that indicates that Torres consented to the officer retaining his ID to conduct a search or to verify it?
That's sort of uncertain. The officer was asked, did he voluntarily produce the identification? Yes, he did. He voluntarily did it. I wasn't threatening him or intimidating him. But as far as the...
he would have had to have done that.
The nitty-gritty specifics of, okay, when you went to run the warrant, did you ask him specifically for consent to allow that? I don't believe that a finding of fact was ever made on that particular point.
So in order to follow up on Justice Douglas's point, wouldn't that fact be necessary in the record to show consent by Torres to the running of the, or to the continued detention?
Yes, that would be an important fact to decide the consent issue.
Yeah.
Well, if it is, though, shouldn't the court have granted the motion to suppress based upon the lack of consent by Mr. Torres to allowing the officer to run the driver's license, or the officer not suspecting that the driver's license was fake, you know, like that is pointed out? Tell us why the judge didn't abuse her discretion in denying the motion to suppress then.
Because the judge said, even assuming this was an unlawful contact, I don't need to decide that issue because this attenuation argument is so compelling, I'm going to jump straight to that and decide it on that. So that's why the court did that. And so maybe I'll move on to the attenuation issue at this point. And first of all, I don't want to take a lot of time on whether or not Brown should apply, but it was a sub-issue that was raised. I'll address that briefly, and then I'll get to the Brown factors as they apply to this case. Appellant has argued initially that Brown is inapplicable to these particular facts because this is different from Brown, which deals with the voluntary confession and the reading of Miranda and that sort of thing. But unanimously, all of the courts, even those eventually holding that the evidence should be suppressed, all of the attenuation cases dealing with the finding of an outstanding warrant have seen fit to decide Brown. The state, or the respondent, is unaware of any court that has acknowledged Brown in this situation and said, we don't think it applies. And I think there's good reasons for applying it, because the applying Brown doesn't replace that language in Wong Sun, which really is the key language. It doesn't replace that. You know, granting establishment of the primary illegality, the issue is whether the evidence has been come at by exploitation of that illegality or by some other means. The court in Green, which was the first appellate court to...
You can proceed. It's a 5 minute. You have 5 minutes. Okay.
Which was the first appellate court to apply Brown to these facts. It enunciated those three factors, but then it went on to state, in the final analysis, however, the ultimate question is still whether the evidence has come at by exploitation of that illegality. It quotes to that Wong Sun language. And I found a couple of U.S. Supreme Court cases that have invoked the Brown language, specifically, for example, in United States versus Lee on the 1984 good faith exception case. It invokes the third prong of Brown in a case not dealing with voluntary confessions. It specifically cites that factor and cites to Brown. And in articulating the Brown case itself, if you look at Brown, in articulating the second factor, the intervening circumstance factor, it cites to Johnson versus Louisiana, an intervening circumstance case that had nothing to do with voluntary confessions. The intervening circumstance in that case was something totally different. And so I think the intent of the U.S. Supreme Court is that these principles be applied generally to attenuation-type cases and not just to voluntary cases where voluntary confessions are the evidence. So I would invite this court to join the sister states and jurisdictions in applying Brown. And in applying Brown, as you've seen from the case law, the tendency and the trend is to de-emphasize factor number one, because it really isn't all that applicable. Factor number two, intervening circumstance, is extremely applicable, but almost unanimously, the courts have found that the existence of an outstanding warrant is an intervening circumstance. And the reason for that is that the arrest performed is conducted incident, or the search that is conducted in these cases is incident to the arrest on the warrant and not incident to the unlawful detention. And the warrant is an intervening circumstance because it provides a legal basis for the arrest, notwithstanding the illegal seizure. And so number three, the factor number three, is really the most important factor because it goes to the heart and the intent and the purpose of the exclusionary rule. Even Brown itself said particularly factor number three is the most important. So what constitutes flagrancy? Well, the plain and ordinary meaning of the term flagrant is shockingly noticeable or evident, obvious, glaring, conspicuously offensive. Arizona said that we should distinguish between ordinary encounters that happen to devolve into illegal seizures and intentionally illegal seizures for the purpose of discovering a warrant. It went on to articulate some helpful factors in determining the flagrancy determination. Factors such as officers' regular practices and routines and officers' reason for initiating the encounter. The clarity of the law forbidding the illegal conduct. I would submit that the fact that courts have gone different ways on the retention of identification and whatnot shows that there isn't a lot of clarity on that particular issue. The officer's reason for initiating the encounter, he didn't set out when he initiated contact with this person. He didn't set out to do a fishing expedition for a warrant. That wasn't his purpose. Even if his what in his mind he thought was reasonable suspicion or a reasonable reason for making contact with this person, maybe if it ends up falling short, you look at the purpose and the intent and the flagrancy. That was never his intent. And there was no evidence in the record that he had a routine practice of randomly approaching people specifically for the reason of conducting a fishing expedition for warrants, requesting their IDs, running their IDs, and looking for warrants. That, I think, would be an abuse of power. That would potentially be flagrant, and that could warrant suppression of the evidence. That is not what we have in this case, not even close. And if you look at Herring, a recent Supreme Court case, the clear trend with the U.S. Supreme Court is to impose a very limited applicability of the exclusionary rule. They said it's a last resort, not a first impulse. It should be applied only in rare and extreme cases of extreme misconduct. Like Brown, for example. That's a great case of extreme misconduct. The Brown case itself. Detectives bust into an apartment without a warrant, without probable cause, search the apartment, wait for the guy to show up. When he shows up, holds him at gunpoint, takes him down to the station, reads him Miranda, and incriminating statements were made later. That's flagrant. That is not what we have here. Officer Shelley was operating in good faith, and under Herring and these other cases dealing with the exclusionary rule, suppression of the evidence is not warranted. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Okay, Ms. Kilpatrick.
Thank you. I'd like to touch upon the state's Leon argument. With regard to Leon, and this goes back to what Justice Hardesty was saying about Heibel, which goes to NRS 171.123. The exclusionary rule, the purpose is for deterrence. This court has held that we do not offer we do not keep evidence when government officials, such as police officers, violate statute. That comes right out of the very recent Kincaid opinion. Officer Shelley violated not only established case law in this jurisdiction, but statute. 171.123 is Nevada's codification of Terry. It was what was taken up in the Heibel case. And 171.123 states that a peace officer may detain any person whom the officer encounters under circumstances which reasonably indicate that the person has committed, is committing, or is about to commit a crime. Well, it says crime, and out past curfew is a juvenile status offense, but that aside. Once Officer Shelley realized that Mr. Torres was not a drunken juvenile, the inquiry should have ended according to statute, because subsection 3 says the officer may detain the person pursuant to this section only to ascertain the person's identity and the suspicious circumstances surrounding the person's presence. That's done. So why doesn't he just give the ID back? Just because he consents to give the ID to say, yes, I am over the age of 21, I am allowed to be out here at night, doesn't imply that he gave consent to retain it, especially in the middle of the night in February when it's cold in Elko. Now,
Patrick, yes. Does your analysis change if the officer returns the ID? He's now been presented with the name Torres, and he lets Torres go.
My analysis does
and
change.
And now he gets into his car, and he calls for a wants and warrants check on the person he has just who's just identified himself as Torres. And it comes back with a wants and warrants check. Can the officer then initiate an arrest?
Yes, if we presume that the initial stop with, hey, can I see you, was constitutional.
Doesn't that analysis suggest that attenuation then really should purge any prior problems that existed with the initial stop?
No, because the result would be post hoc rationalization of Fourth Amendment stops that would completely obliterate any deterrence. The police could just stop and randomly talk to anyone they want and run a wants and warrants check for no reason at all. And perhaps they could get lucky. Perhaps that lucky break will come down from dispatch and the warrant will be rescued and the stop will be cleansed by the presence of the warrant. It goes back to the purpose of the exclusionary rule. If we hold that a warrant is an intervening circumstance that cleanses an illegal stop, that's what's going to happen, and we don't want that to happen.
Ms. Clevet, can I just ask you a question? Finally, Justice Sherry, yeah, I thought a very intriguing question about the stop on a traffic violation. You give them your insurance and your driver's license, and they run, presumably for warrants and all. How would you differentiate that scenario? Is it because it's a vehicle is treated different than a pedestrian or what? How should we take a look at that type of situation?
I think we should look at that under Beckman and decide whether or not the retention of the warrant, or excuse me, the retention of the ID and running for warrants extends the length of the stop.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very interesting case. We appreciate you driving from Elko County over here for the oral arguments, and we'll take the case under submission, and we'll be in recess till